I'm Christopher Lydon, looking for an alternative manual, a sort of plan B narrative of this 2012 presidential campaign. I'm back at Yale with the historian Timothy Snyder. And together we're looking for clues in the last warnings, a lot of them spoken in the voice of an inspired, angry, biblical prophet by Tim's colleague and friend, Tony Jutt. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one is different because the authority we're summoning, Tony Jutt, died of Lou Gehrig's disease almost 2 years ago. But to read the last two books that Tony Jutt produced with Timothy Snyder's help, as Tony Jutt's body withered, is to feel the heat and the light gone missing in our public square. It's to feel the anxiety and the dread roiling just under the surface of American life. And it's to sort fearlessly, in Tony Jutt's example, through the history, the economic trends, the ideas that brought us to an age of insecurity, maybe a new age of fear. The two books at hand are Tony Jutt's last Cassandra collection of essays titled Ill Fares the Land, and then the autobiography conversation that Timothy Snyder had with Tony Jutt to his last gasp in 2010. It was called Thinking the 20th Century. How do we reopen the conversation when we need it, Tim Snyder, with Tony Jutt?
Well, Tony left an awful lot behind, which most of us haven't read yet, and the simplest thing to do would be to read his books. The nice thing about history is that history doesn't go when people go. We're quite sentimental about death, and that's one of the things which Tony himself despised was sentiment, and he wouldn't have liked nostalgia either, I don't think. History means that we leave behind a trace. And that's a trace that other people can follow after we ourselves are gone. And that's a basic important idea about history, because it suggests that when this or that historian is gone, this or that thinker is gone, they might still have left a path which we can follow. And in Tony's case, that's really very much true, I think, that the main thing that you need for that path or the starting point, you know, the first tree with the first marker, which tells you where that path might be, is the idea that history itself is continuing. That's the alert. That's the blinking sign. That's the thing that you must understand, that history is still going on. Anyone who tells you that history is not still going on is trying to induce you into a kind of slumber, you know, in which you will disempower yourself, or in which you will take part in a story which the only consequence of which will be to disempower you, because of course history is going on. I mean, there were all sorts of ways in the 20th century that people tried to stress this. You know, the Czech novelist Milan Kundera, who appears in this conversation I have with Tony, said that the struggle of man against power is a struggle of memory against forgetting. And that seems so straightforward. But we seem to be looking in America for opportunities to end history. You know, that Fukuyama's famous essay and then book, the idea after the 9/11 that nothing like this has ever happened before, that all the rules have changed and so on. We're constantly looking for ways to end history. In other words, we're looking for ways to slumber. And people are providing us all the time with it, with the down feathers of history ending so that we can lay down our heads and be oppressed. So one can disagree about what history means, where it's going, and so on. But the starting thing, I mean, the fundament of having any kind of public conversation is the idea that what happened before matters for what's going to happen now. And in some sense, we're all in that process together. The moment where we agree that history isn't going on anymore is the moment where we're leaving history to someone else. So that's the fundamental thing, right, that you have to start with. And then from there, you might move on to trying to understand what history was.
Has to begin to say what it was he said. I'm looking at one page of hundreds that we could quote, but he says about the politics of fear in the book, Ill Fares the Land, we have entered an age of fear. Insecurity is once again an active ingredient of political life in Western democracies. Insecurity born of terrorism, of course, but also, and more insidiously, fear of the uncontrollable speed of change, fear of the loss of employment, fear of losing ground to others in an increasingly unequal distribution of resources, fear of losing control of the circumstances and routines of our daily life. And perhaps, above all, fear that it is not just we who can no longer shape our lives, but that those in authority have lost control. There's a framework here, Timothy Snyder, in Tony Jutt's last book, and with you. There's a horizon of history. There's an enormous amount of observed detail, especially about rising inequality in the world and especially in the United States, and the decline of well-being that comes with it. And I must say, the reader, me, picks it up with a kind of relief. I mean, finally, somebody is spelling it out and pulling it together. There's an argument here. You said, in some fashion, it could be a catalog of the malaise that shows up so obviously in this campaign year. And I kept thinking, you know, you could read a lot of this description to the Tea Party. You could read a lot of it to the Occupy kids at different poles of American life. And they'd both say, yeah, I'm going over the edge about it. Did he or you sort of conceive it this way, as look together at the deeper anxiety here?
I think the word together is the most important word in your question. In Tony's view, patriotism and the state go together, whereas in American public life, they're generally presented as opposites. So people say, and very often believe, that it's patriotic to want the government not to do anything. Whereas Tony's view was that there are certain things which the government does or ought to do, which are not only just in of themselves, they're also productive of that thing which makes us believe that we belong to a community. In other words, just to take a simple example, which turns up in thinking the 20th century, if you and I ride the train together every day, we might see each other, have a conversation, and so on. But if there is no train, that isn't going to happen. Mm. What's going to happen then is that if you're rich and I'm poor, someone's going to drive you, right? And I'm going to carpool, or I'm going to hitch a ride, or I'm going to drive myself and wait in traffic or whatever it might be. And then there is no conversation. And so this thing which appears only to be a convenience, in some sense, is also a catalyst of that thing which we think of as patriotism. You know, the way that Americans think about patriotism very often is as a kind of magic. It just sort of exists because we're great people. And of course, that's nonsense. Patriotism only exists because people are in a position to engage each other. And so inequality is not just a problem of injustice. Inequality is also a problem for the continuation of the American nation as we understand it. Insofar as people are very, very rich, they can cut themselves off from the concerns of everyone else. And that means that if you care about the American nation, which, you know, people claim that they do, what you need to do is make sure that there are state policies which ensure that the rich and the poor and everyone else are in some way interacting with each other, are aware of each other's concerns. So I stress that this is a different way of approaching this, the problem of justice and the problem of patriotism. Because in America, we've convinced ourselves that these two things are entirely different. In some sense, they're in a competition with each other. You know, you're on the right, you care about patriotism. You're on the left, you care about justice. Whereas I think one of the points that Tony was trying to make in his careful piece-by-piece defense of social democracy is that you cannot have one without the other. You can't have one without the other. Even if all you care about is American patriotism, if you don't have American justice, you're going to lose that as well. You're going to lose the patriotism as well, which I think, frankly, is happening before our eyes as we watch.
You've introduced the magic phrase social democracy. He spoke of it in many different ways, a compromise that keeps alive a sort of socialist dream in a capitalist world, a sort of mixed way of prose living in prose. How do you define it? For him, it was the last ideal of the 20th century. We saw it for a moment and lost it. What is it?
I think it's about growing up, frankly. I think it's about intellectual and political maturity. The maturity which, I don't mean that just as a compliment, I mean it as a kind of demand that we are not going to get through the 21st century if we continue with the kind of, you know, intellectually pubescent dreaming which dominated the 20th century. What do I mean by that? I mean the fundamental idea, you know, which I'm sure you and I don't know about you, I would have been drawn to it. Almost everybody I know, I think, would have been drawn to it in the 20th century. The idea that history has a story. There's a plot to history. There isn't just a beginning, you know, long ago, the middle that we're in now, but there's also a kind of end that you can foresee. You know where things are going. That idea, you know, that history with a big H, was incredibly powerful to hundreds of millions of people, many of whom meant very well and were acting in good faith. That is the thing we no longer have. We no longer have it as a matter of fact because the Soviet Union collapsed, but we also no longer have it because we had so many people who very wisely ceased to be communists or dissented and came up with other ideas of how the future might look depending upon how we choose to act. Now, when I say pubescent, I mean, now that I'm stuck with that sort of insulting metaphor, I'm going to continue it. We think we have put that all behind, but in fact, we have not. In fact, in America in the 21st century, you know, we've sort of embraced pimply-faced politics with a real vigor. We hug our teenage selves, basically. We think we've said, oh, goodbye to all that. We've learned a lesson from communism, but we have not. We have not learned the lesson from communism. What we have done instead is that we've taken a story which is very much like the communist story, and we've made it our own. You know, we think we know the future. We think that if you intervene in the marketplace, it inevitably leads to authoritarianism, blah, 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 right? That is a story like the Marxist story. It's just the opposite. You know, the Marxist story says capitalism will inevitably destroy itself. Our story says capitalism will inevitably protect itself. Each of those stories is equally stupid, and each of them is equally historically falsifiable and falsified by history, which is going back to your first question. You know, you have to remember 2008, you have to remember 1930, just to have the basic idea that capitalism is not this pure natural thing which defends itself, right? Capitalism requires a certain amount of intervention. And, you know, I think capitalism is what we've got, and we have to make the best of it. I don't think there are alternatives. But the idea that it's a natural, pure thing leading to a certain future is the same idea the communists had. It's just in reverse. So what we have done is that we've accepted an ideology which has the same structure, you know, as communist ideology, that it's all about capitalism, it leads to a certain future, and we've transformed that into common sense and national mission, right? So we are still in intellectual adolescence. So what I think Tony was trying to do basically was to say, grow up, like drop the story about how everything's going to turn out great in the end if you only do nothing, right? I mean, that's a Hollywood idea. All you have to do is lean back in your seats and eat popcorn. And at the end, you know, something good's going to happen. And your role is just to look at it and watch it happen. That's an adolescent idea. I think what intellectual maturity demands is that you put aside not just the one story, which was somebody else's story, but you put aside stories themselves. You put them aside. You say, okay, if certain things are good, you know, I used the examples before of patriotism and justice, both of which I happen to think are good things. If you think certain things are good, then you have to think about how you patch things together, what you need to do practically to make those things come about.
You speak of growing up, but also hugging our teenage selves. I want to hug mine for a moment, just because I grew up in a period that Tony Judt identified as the high watermark of social democracy in American history, 1945 to 1975. Big family, six kids with a disabled father. We were all hustlers. We all went through fabulous schools, including Yale, on scholarships. Didn't have a dime of debt to repay when we went out onto the world. But we'd also grown up in an atmosphere. For me, the Boston Public Library, the most important building in the city, symbolized it all. The public library of the city of Boston, built by the people for the advancement of learning. And then along the Boylston Street side, it says, and my father loved this line, the commonwealth requires the education of the people as the safeguard of order and liberty. And that kind of consensus of general well-being, and it was also, I must say, a time of tremendous expansion, not only in the economy, but in the great schools sort of seeking out non-legacy talent, blah, 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 and later women. But it was a time of a huge, if implied, and very robust investment in the whole megillah, the whole game. What happened?
You're messing with my metaphor, because then what I have to say is that we've kind of returned to adolescence. And it's a good point you make, because what's interesting about America today is that we are to the right of, you know, we are to the right of Reagan, as I think Obama just correctly said, but we're to the right of Nixon. You know, someone like Richard Nixon, all of his flaws, which I would be the last to deny, he basically took for granted what we would call social democracy. He basically took for granted the intervention of the state and society, that the role of the state is to create possibilities for upward mobility and so on, which I think is the central point in what you're making, which is a very important one, and a different way of making a point that I was trying to make earlier, namely that the state is not fundamentally there to magically transform the lives of the truly disadvantaged. There are things that the state can do and should do for them. But what the state can really do, and what the welfare state really does, is that it creates middle classes. Mm-hmm. The welfare state creates middle classes. It creates the possibility for people who want to work hard to go into the middle class by taking care of certain things for them. You stressed education, which I think is thing number one. And I think thing number two is health. It is very hard to make your way up into the middle classes without public education, and it's very hard to stay there without someone helping you to take care of your health. If you're if you have to pay for it yourself, or if you have to obsess about it, then it's very difficult to land both psychologically and financially in the middle classes. So that's another tricky thing about the way U.S. politics operates today, is that we think as soon as someone says welfare state, people immediately think of poor black people. You know, it's racially coded, right? But it, in fact, the welfare state, when it functions, what it does is that it creates opportunities for everyone, whether they're black, white, whatever. It creates generic opportunities for people to move up into the middle classes. And to put it in the reverse, what you can observe in the last 20 years is that if you do not have a welfare state, the middle class that you have will dissolve, right? The middle class doesn't just exist. It is now dissolving in this country, and it's dissolving in part because there aren't schools to put your kids in, and because everyone spends so much money and also so much worry on what they're going to do when they're sick.
Well, that's why I love the Boston Public Library as a metaphor of everything, including health. But it went up in 1895, the year that my grandparents from Connemara arrived in Boston. And it was, the fundamental formula was, hey, illiterate peasants from Ireland, read a book, learn how to read a book, and you'll have a ticket to the American middle class. And by gum, it worked that way in my family and in thousands, maybe millions of families. Same time, the New York Public Library was going up on fundamentally the same premise, I think.
In fairness, one also has to say that your generation was, in some ways, a fortunate one in that there wasn't just a state which was providing opportunities. There was also a world economy in which the United States occupied an especially favorable place due to all kinds of accidents having to do with the Second World War.
Sure.
And that's a situation which can't really be repeated. And so I think when we make serious arguments about social democracy, we have to answer the question, isn't this social democracy thing going to tank the economy? Which is another important element of American discourse. If you say or I say we really need to make sure that there's clean water, or we really need to make sure, you know, that Johnny's second grade teacher is good, or we really need to make sure that there are public parks, people immediately say, well, look at the European Union, it's collapsing, right? That's what people immediately say. They say, okay, there's this example of the welfare state, it's Europe, and Europe doesn't work. Europe is collapsing. And people have been saying this basically for the last 20 years or longer. And so you have to be able to say, no, what you need to spend for a functional welfare state is actually not that much money, and that it pays for itself. I mean, health insurance is a wonderful example of this. If you have a single payer system, healthcare actually ends up costing much, much, much less, partly because you don't have the middleman, which is what, you know, the healthcare industry in the United States is. It's just a middleman. You know, it's just the troll that stands on the bridge and takes money from you so you can cross the bridge. It doesn't actually provide anything. It just profits. But the other reason is that when government is in charge of healthcare, then all of a sudden governments have an incentive to make sure that costs are low rather than high, right? They're not profit-making institutions. And so that means they focus on things like prenatal care and preventive care, right? So there are ways in which the welfare state actually suppresses costs and makes the economy work better. And I stress this because if you're going to defend these things, you run against the argument that no, you can't do that because it costs too much. And I think it actually doesn't cost, it really ends up probably saving more money in the end.
Timothy Snyder, in your own terms, lay out what has come to be the master narrative of campaigns like the one we're in. I mean, on the Romney side, roughly, we're getting, oddly enough, what Tony Judd identifies as the curse of Vienna, a sort of mid-century argument between Hayek, Mr. Road to Serfdom, and Maynard Keynes. But the rough idea that government crushes enterprise and ultimately freedom, that government is the fat man on your back, as Bibi Netanyahu said to Mitt Romney, it turns out. Or in Margaret Thatcher's terms, that, hey, there is no such thing as society. It's all about individuals and families. That's the sort of the right bumper sticker. And on the left, sort of a tattered bumper sticker to the effect that the government is the indispensable partner and maybe savior of the capitalist system. In your own terms, I mean, cast the debate.
Again, this goes back to your first question about why, you know, what Tony stands for. Why does the past fundamentally matter? The past matters here in two ways. The first is that it allows you to see how the things you think are common sense or the things that you think are Mitt Romney making a speech are in fact part of an intellectual genealogy that leads back to a certain place, right? That it's not just truth, it's not just the present, but it's an argument that has a certain shape that came from somewhere. The second thing that history allows you to do is allows you to check whether that argument is right. You know, if that argument has been made for 70 years, then we've had 70 years of experience and we can check it, right? We don't have to assume that it's true just because everybody thinks it, because of course, in general, what everybody thinks in a given moment is probably not true, right? So the first thing is you can trace the genealogy. Here's the genealogy. There was a Great Depression. Hitler came to power in Germany and then in Austria. After that, there were East European communist takeovers. Friedrich Hayek, who was an Austrian economist, made the argument, which he lost in public debate. Everyone agreed that he lost it, including himself, that intervention in the economy could not work. Then he shifted gears and he made the argument, a very different argument, the one which is popular today, which says intervention in the economy leads to political oppression. You know, it's a road to serfdom. And this is, of course, what I meant when I was saying earlier that there is a counter story to Marxism, which just looks just like Marxism. This idea that there's a road, right? There's a road to anything, whether it's serfdom or liberation, and that as soon as you take one step down that road, the road swallows you up and leads you to that abyss or that utopia, you know, as the case may be. That is a deeply 20th century way of looking things. So what Hayek did was he took the Marxist view that capitalism was going to lead to revolution and said, no, capitalism is going to preserve freedom. Fine. So that's where it comes from. So every time you know, Romney says these things, we should be asking ourselves, do we really want to take seriously what Friedrich Hayek said about the fate of Austria and Central Europe in the 30s and 40s? Because that's what it's really all about. Yeah. Nothing's been added to it since then, which leads me to the second thing. Was Hayek right? And the answer is no. He got it exactly backwards. If you look at Austria in the 1930s, Austria was not a state that intervened in the economy. On the contrary, Austria was one of the states in Europe which did the least Keynesian intervention in the economy. It did the opposite. It balanced its budgets. It had very tight money. And the result was that the Great Depression was catastrophic in Austria. And the result of that was that many people in Austria were in fact attracted to Hitler's ideas and to National Socialist Germany because they saw it as the only answer to unemployment. So there, the truth is exactly the opposite. When you do not intervene, you create a possibility for political catastrophe. Then what happens after the war? What happens after the war is that throughout Western and Central Europe, where it's possible, the Americans finance, by way of the Marshall Plan, the possibility of something like a welfare state. And they do it quite consciously. I mean, this is how Truman thinks about it. This is how George Marshall thinks about it, that if you give the state the capacity to do certain things, then you will have a smaller threat from both the far right and from the far left. They're trying to stop communist revolution, and they're also trying to stop a return to fascism. And it works. So the historical lesson, not only of Austria, where this is true, but of Western Europe in general, is that if you have a decently funded welfare state, it cuts off the extremes of right and left. So again, the opposite of what Hayek would have predicted. You take these places like Germany and France and Italy, which either were threatened by extremes of the right and the left, and you turn them into democracies. How do you do that? You do it by having something like the welfare state, right? Austria becomes a prosperous democratic state as a social democratic state after the Second World War. So basically, Hayek has it exactly wrong. History tells exactly the opposite story about the pre-war, about the post-war, about the Nazis, about the communists. If history tells exactly the opposite story. So what Hayek gives us is this nice, simple version, which happens to be incredibly convenient to people who want to practice the politics of inequality and fear. But it has nothing to do with reality. It's just a story.
Tim Snyder, have at the other side of the argument, including its flaws, the notion that a kind of pragmatic mixture of principles in democracy and capitalism and social welfare gets you to the happy horizon, which is not exactly where Europe is at these days. I mean, what's that argument and what's wrong with it?
The main thing which is wrong with it is that it's not any fun. It's not any fun. It's much more fun to say there's going to be a glorious communist revolution or there's going to be glorious capitalist prosperity. That's really lots of fun because it means that all you have to do is identify yourself with the right side of history and everything's going to go your way. So, you know, people who truly believe the Austrian school, you know, who believe things like Romney says he thinks, I think in fact he doesn't believe it, but people who believe those things they're in the same happy position that Communist Party members were, you know, in the 20s and 30s, because they can just say, I understand history, it's going my way, it has laws, you know, all I have to do is watch and it's going to follow these wondrous laws and everything's going to be okay. That's happy, that's nice, it means you don't have to think. It means you just have to follow, you just have to obey, you have to obey history, but in particular you have to obey the people who are explaining history to you, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a very happy position. It's a very simple position because there's only one thing that matters. The only thing that matters, again, in both the communist and the Hayekian version, the only thing that matters is the economy. Nothing else really matters. So it's a very simple and happy place to be. The problem with the kind of messy pluralist case that Tony was trying to make is that it's unhappy. It doesn't reduce everything down to one factor. It requires tons of political judgment. You know, okay, we agree that clean water is important. We agree that education is important. Fine. But how much money and who are we going to tax and how much are we going to tax and how are we going to arrange the taxes? How much do the poor have to pay? How much do the rich have to pay? Should Ohio have to help Michigan? Should Michigan have to help Maine? These are all these questions of political judgment which are difficult and which are boring, right? So it's much nicer to stay in these happy roads, you know, roads to utopia or roads to dystopia, whether it's Hayek or Marx that you're following. So the main problem of it is that it's a tough case to make. You know, because you don't have these pretty stories. And the main virtue of what Tony was trying to do, I think, at the end of his life, was that he was trying to say that even without the stories, precisely because we don't have the stories, or if we do still have the stories, we should let go of them, we need to build up the case. We need to build up the case for justice and patriotism. So you mentioned Europe. And what's wrong with Europe? Well, no matter what happens in Europe, there's a very large group of Americans who are going to say, oh yes, that shows that social democracy can't work. What's happening in Europe today does not really show that. For one thing, social democracy, that part of it is still going very well. You know, if you go to Europe and you have a heart attack or need to have a baby, you're going to be admitted to the hospital and people are going to treat you very well, which is just not true in this country, unfortunately. If you go to Europe and you drop in, your kid is probably going to have decent public education, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, without you having to think about it very much, and certainly without you having to pay very much for it. What is going wrong in Europe at this point are two things. The first is that Greece is very much like the United States, to make a point which somehow nobody ever mentioned in this country, in that it has wealth inequality, and it has lots of rich people who avoid paying taxes. You know, rich people not paying taxes is pretty much always the sign that a state's about to fail. And Greece has that problem just as the United States has that problem, right? And it's interesting that we're about to elect somebody who, you know, I'll be interested to see how many taxes he paid in 2008 and 2009 if we ever find out.
Do we know who we're going to elect?
Oh, no, it would be interesting that we're considering electing, you know, someone. Because, no, this, I mean, this is another lesson of history, that you can tell states are about to fall when the wealthy people who have to be their bulwark are no longer contributing. You know, they're making their bets elsewhere, or the state isn't strong enough to make them pay taxes. And that's kind of where we are now, which is one of the reasons why I worry. I mean, not only do we have very rich people who don't pay very many taxes, we have this argument that it's bad to make them pay taxes. And Mitt Romney kind of incorporates that argument, at least I think very well. And the reason why I mention him is that I suspect that in the 2 years, not the last two where he did review, I suspect in the 2 years before that, he probably didn't pay any taxes, which would be a sort of song, you know, of distress for our politics, that we'd even be considering electing somebody who didn't pay any taxes. Anyway, I was trying to go somewhere a little bit different with that, which is that the first thing which is wrong with Europe is that, you know, rich people don't pay taxes. Common problem. We should recognize it as such. The second thing which went wrong in Europe is that Europe tried to have monetary policy, that is the euro for the whole eurozone, without having fiscal policy. There's no common European budget or treasury. So in other words, they didn't have the ability to make precisely Keynesian interventions into the economy. If they had that ability, they wouldn't have had this crisis. Mm. So you can look at the European crisis and say, no, it's not actually a case for the failure of Keynesianism. It's an example of what happens when you can't practice Keynesianism. So we don't have that problem, fortunately. We do have not only a single currency, but we also have a treasury and a budget. So we can do those things.
You mentioned Keynes, who was surely, in Tony Judd's reckoning and others, the counterpart of the Hayek argument. I mean, we are all Keynesians, we say now, but are we? Should we be? What are we learning about his view?
I think the reason why Tony liked Keynes so much, aside from the fact that Keynes was in many ways the kind of well-rounded intellectual who we don't really have anymore, that Keynes was also incredibly witty, that Keynes had a profound historical significance, I think all those things made Keynes attractive to Tony. But the fundamental thing that I think Tony liked about Keynes was that the system was an anti-system. The system doesn't say, here's a way of understanding history, here's the road, let's march on the road. What Keynes said was, while you're marching on the road, boulders are going to fall down from the cliff, trees are going to fall down, and we can't predict the hurricanes which are going to come. We don't know exactly when they're going to be, but we know they're going to be hurricanes, mm-hmm. right? And so what that means, with that view of history, which happens to be, I think, the correct view of history, broadly speaking, that you know, it's a very simple proposition. You know stuff is going to happen, but you don't know exactly what it's going to be, mm-hmm. right? With that view of history, or with that view of capitalism, that there are going to be crises, but you don't know exactly when those crises are going to be, then the recommended mode is one of adjustment and stabilization. So when a crisis comes, you don't somehow say, this is all for the best, right? You don't somehow say, oh, it's really good to have millions and millions and millions of people unemployed because it's a necessary correction of the system. Or it's really, really good to have millions and millions of people unemployed because this is going to lead to revolution. Again, note how the Hayek story and the Marx story are the same story, or how similar they look. It's, okay, something horrible happened. People are suffering, right? But that's good. It's actually good because, you know, it brings us further along the story. What Keynes says is, hold on, neither of those versions are right. It's simply not a good thing to have millions and millions and millions of people unemployed. That's a bad thing in and of itself. It's not just unjust. It threatens the workings of the system. And so if we want the system to work, we have to make sure that we are in a position to react flexibly when things like this happen. So what Keynes recommends concretely is less important, I think, than that view of history or than that view of the economy, which is the economy isn't necessarily leading us towards something inevitably, and all our role in it is just to say rah, 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 even when, you know, what it's bringing us is depression and suffering. Our role in the history of the economy is to say, okay, capitalism is what we've got. It produces lots of wealth. It can lift lots of people out of poverty. It produces innovation and technology. It has many, many, many virtues, but it also has a problem. And its problem is endemic instability. Although we can't predict just when instability is coming, we know it's generally going to come. One of the tasks of government is to have a bag of tricks to react whenever you do have those episodes of instability. So it's not a system. It's a kind of anti-system. It doesn't say the way history is great, or the way history is terrible, or that things are going inevitably in a certain direction. What it says is, okay, we've got this phenomenon, capitalism. It's a little bit vague. It's hard to get your mind around. It's not pure. It's not simple. It's something that, though, you have to be able to push and nudge a little bit here and there. You can't change it. It's what we've got. But you have to be able, you have to be intellectually flexibly enough to have a political toolkit which allows you to influence it when the time comes.
Tim Snyder, digress a little bit from 2012 and American politics about you and Tony Judd as professionals and friends. On two points. One, you were both deeply, deeply engaged in the history of Eastern Europe, especially between World War I and II, but in the cultural changes and damage and growth after the war. And then there's this whole business, which I read with a certain awe, of you interviewing this man, friend, colleague, as he's dying of Lou Gehrig's disease. We're in the room with you, in a fashion, as you write this book, and I'm thinking, God, talk about added difficulties, or talk about extra points in an interviewing situation, but the huge skill and humor and detail and learning that gets into this exchange. Start with Eastern Europe. What did that contribute to your take on where we are now?
Tony and I were of different generations, and so Eastern Europe meant different things to us. Tony was of the generation of 1968, whereas I am of what one of our common friends called the generation of 1989. Tony was, in some ways, a typical member of that generation. He took part in the revolutions of 68. He was interested in Western Europe. He had very little idea of what was going on the eastern side of the Iron Curtain. What was interesting about Tony, and this is one of the chapters in the middle of Thinking the 20th Century, is that somewhere around midlife, late 30s, early 40s, he realized that this was a shortcoming in his education and in his worldview, and he sought to overcome it. He made friends who were from Poland. He learned the Czech language, and this allowed him to change and, I think, to become better. It allowed him, to make the point very simply, it allowed him to liberate himself from whatever residual Marxism still functioned in him at that point. But it also, in a more positive sense, I think, gave him a different idea of human dignity, an individualistic idea of human dignity, a pluralist idea of human dignity. Whereas for me, generationally, it all works very differently. I'm coming into political awareness at the time of the revolutions of 1989. I, too, have grown up in a divided world, but it's a divided world which which comes to an end when I'm 20. And that's rather different from it coming to an end when you're 41. And so for me, Eastern Europe is the opportunity. You know, Eastern Europe is this romantic place where one can go. And of course, when you go there, you learn things that are entirely not romantic. And much of my work is about the mass killing, which I think defines Eastern Europe in the middle of the 20th century. But with Tony, I shared a certain awareness of how East Europeans had tried to break down the big Marxist story. And once you have that experience of a story being broken down by, you know, little jabs here and little jabs there, you can then start to think critically about other big stories, which I think is something Tony and I had in common. Which brings me to the second question. Eastern Europe, in a way, also enabled the conversation. It enabled the conversation because Tony, as someone who took an interest in Eastern European history, was also taking an interest in people who practiced it, people who were much younger than himself. He took an interest in me when I didn't matter at all, when I was just some unemployed student wandering about, you know, provincial capitals and living on bread. And he did that for many, many, many people. But because he was interested in Eastern Europe, he and I had that together. But also, the form that this book takes is a very East European form. One of the very, very best books of East European history is something called My Century, which was written by Czesław Miłosz in conversation with Aleksander Watt. It's a conversation. It's one of the books that if you read it, it invites you into East European history. Another example of this is the conversation between the Czech writer Karel Čapek and the Czechoslovak president, Tomáš Masaryk, which, as it happened, was the first book that Tony had ever read in Czech. So there's this tradition of talking books and perhaps also a certain tradition of excessive, you know, friendship, which is East European. And we had all of that, and that helped us to do this. You know, and as far as the difficulties of all this, I think the difficulties of doing this are apparent. And they're, you know, almost entirely on Tony's side. And the fact that he was able to do all of this is a testimony to many, many virtues of his. And I will just mention one of them, and that is concentration. This exchange could not have happened without the possibility of his abstracting himself from the terrible and declining physical condition in which he found himself, to abstract himself from that and to think about the books and the world and the ideas that we had in common. And he was able to do that to a degree which really approached perfection.
Spell that out.
Well, we were both writers who in some measure understood each other and appreciated each other and admired each other, one of whom could not write in the traditional sense. What I proposed to Tony to do, and what he eventually agreed was a good idea, is that we talk a book. Talk a book because he had lost the use of his hands and arms at that point from ALS, from Lou Gehrig's disease. And so I had the thought, I mean, it was an instantaneous thought, it was an instinct, a sympathetic instinct, which went, if I couldn't use my hands and arms, I would still want to write. So what, you know, what could I do for Tony? And partly this was, you know, a friendly gesture in that Tony and I were friends. Partly it was the gesture of someone who was younger than Tony and had been helped by Tony. Tony, one of the things that Tony was a meritocrat. So he looked out below him at the people he thought were good, and then he tried to promote them in various ways. And that meant hundreds of people. And I was one of those people. In some sense, I represent them. But part of it was also a collegial gesture in that I regarded Tony as extraordinary as a historian, as a thinker. So I wanted to do something for him, but I also wanted to do something, so to speak, that was him or that would produce more of him, because he was capable of doing so much. And I knew him well enough to know that he was capable of doing it in speech, that he was extraordinarily articulate, as he liked to put it. He was able to speak in paragraphs. So, but I had a kind of aesthetic appreciation of Tony's mind, you know, which was distinct from Tony's own views of how good Tony was. I thought of this as a kind of, you know, if you like, a kind of national treasure, right? Like if you know that the Grand Canyon is going to be filled with toxins tomorrow, you go to the Grand Canyon and you take photographs, right? Part of it was that impulse as well, that there was something here which should be preserved. That's how it got started.
How was it he could somehow compartmentalize the death of his body and the frenzy in his head?
I mean, that's a question that I can never adequately answer. I mean, Tony tried to answer it himself in some of his essays and a bit in the conclusion of this book that we did together. But I think one way to think about the answer to that question is to think of the way that Tony himself dodged it. You know, sometimes the way people dodge questions really is the answer. And the way that Tony dodged the question was that he said and believed, I think truly believed, that the ideas were much more important you know, than the sentiment. And I think his mind was structured appropriately for that. Tony's and my relationship, you know, to put it in a very simple way, was not a physical relationship. I mean, it was important to me that I could shake his hand, and it was important to me that I was in the same room with him and so on. But you know, our relationship was really a relationship which was always about ideas, the content of the ideas, the chase after ideas, the remaking of ideas. And those were things which Tony had in his mind. And he, as we said before, that he was always able to express very well by way of speech and not just in writing. So in that sense, what Tony and I were doing was something which played to what had always been his strength. And in some sense, it became more of his strength as his body declined, because his powers of concentration, which were always enviable, I think actually improved as he found himself with little else to do besides trying to order his thoughts. But of course, that he took it that way speaks of virtues that are more than intellectual. It speaks of virtues which are also, for lack of a better word, virtues which are also moral, because it was a choice on his part to agree to speak with me. It was a choice on his part to undertake all this other intellectual labor as well.
It was a choice on his part to make a huge effort to serve a public discourse. And that, I must say, is what I find most interesting and very moving about his last life. I mean, he really cared about the public conversation, in which, as a journalist, you know, I've been a bit player for most of my life. But this was of desperate importance to him. I'm looking at one page in Ill Fares the Land where he writes, "Liberation is an act of the will. We cannot hope to reconstruct our dilapidated public conversation, no less than our crumbling physical infrastructure, unless we become sufficiently angry at our present condition. No democratic state should be able to make illegal war on the basis of a deliberate lie and get away with it. The silence surrounding the contemptibly inadequate response of the Bush administration to Hurricane Katrina bespeaks a depressing cynicism toward the responsibilities and capacities of the state. We expect Washington to underperform." In the book with you, he's devastating about, you know, the great institutions of public discourse in this country, including the New York Times op-ed and the people that he had to deal with on Charlie Rose and the sort of the common run of the intellectual establishment. And I say, three cheers for you, man. That's part of the crisis.
Tony is trying to prove, and I think he does prove, that ideas and words have their own force. Because if ideas and words have their own force, that creates a responsibility on our part to know ideas and to know their history. And it also creates a responsibility on our part to treat the language respectfully and to use it in a way which is not only true, but effective. And that's hard. Mm-hmm. It's much easier to say, as many public intellectuals in the U.S. now say, oh, ideas don't matter anymore. They might have mattered in the 20th century, but where we are living now, there aren't any ideas anymore. And it's much easier to write badly, right, than it is to write well, and to speak badly than it is to write well. The temptations to, you know, to cast away ideas and to cast away literary form are there in everyday life. And they're all the stronger if you believe some story about how things have to go the way they're going. Because if you believe that things have to go the way they're going, you know, then all you're doing is writing in such a way that approximates that thing that you think is going to happen anyway. That was a problem for communist writers. It's a problem, you know, it's a problem for I think many journalists now, is that there are these overwhelming ideas about the way things really work, and they just kind of tailor to that. What Tony is trying to prove is that ideas and words have an autonomous force. And if that's true, then that puts the burden, or at least some burden, on us to take the ideas and the words that are out there and to criticize them and to improve upon them, not just because they're wrong, but because in so doing, we're doing part of what we would have to do to make things better. That is, you know, that is one of the whole lessons of intellectual history from the Dreyfus affair forward, that it can actually matter if you understand what's going on and put it sharply, that might actually not just describe history, but change it, maybe just a little bit. And it's that just a little bit, which is really all we can hope for. But, you know, that's the case that Tony was trying to make. Another way to think about this is the realm of possible argument. When you think about the kind of internet or 24-hour news cycle news that we have now, it all, interestingly, we have a million sources, but the conversation is incredibly narrow. You know, what you can say without people getting outraged or without people thinking you're off message or whatever is very, very narrow from day to day. And what Tony was trying to do, I think, was broaden that. The more narrow the public discourse is, the harder it is to actually change what's going on. Right? Because insofar as you have control, direct, indirect, what you try to do is you keep conversation bounded. Whereas an intellectual's job is to say, you know, this conversation we're having right now, it doesn't have that much to do with the reality that prevails. We should be having a different conversation, right? And so what Tony was able to do, and it's hard to find anyone else in America who can do this, was he was able to say, let's have a conversation which is different. Let's have a broader conversation. You know, he wasn't always right, but I mean, he did have that ability to say this, to say, I'm going to cast my stone way over here, and I'm going to make you deal with that. You know, whereas in general, the pressure is narrow, 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 until even when we disagree, we're disagreeing about things where it doesn't really matter where we disagree.
He was drawing on the great Emersonian view that, you know, every man must be a nonconformist, and a nonconformist even with yourself or what you were saying and writing last week, if need be. He was also drawing, of course, on Orwell and the general notion that a corruption of language and a corruption in politics go hand in hand. They're two symptoms of the same thing. I'm also fascinated that he wrote bold things in Ill Fares the Land like this. He said, we must act upon our intuitions of impending catastrophe. Like, don't wait for some guy in a suit to come up and tell you we're in trouble. We're in trouble. But he also said it more cheerfully, we have to theorize our better instincts. He believed in the word, obviously.
One of the things that Tony had his finger on, and which made him so irritating to so many people, was a certain clash between America's declared values and American practice. We declare that we are in favor of free speech. We declare that we are a country of individuals, of nonconformists. Mm-hmm. But in fact, it is really hard to get across an opinion at any given time, which is very far away from the opinion that prevails. And in general, we are an extraordinarily conformist society. Our intellectual life is quite impoverished compared, I think, not just to, you know, compared to other countries, but compared to America 20 years ago, for that matter. And the main problem is conformism. And conformism is, of course, related to fear. So Tony, I think, believed that although there were no big truths anymore, and we never ought to have believed them, no big truths which tell you everything you need to know about the past and future, there was such a thing as truth. You could say that certain things were true or not true, and that the truth itself is always nonconformist. It's generally not in anyone's interest or anyone's collective interest for the truth to be known. But sometimes it's in the interest of the entire society that we know truth. It's a very simple proposition, but it's an important one, because once the idea that there is truth goes out the window, then we find ourselves in a very conservative, I think, a very conservative, this is now me, not Tony, a very conservative conformist space. Because if there's no longer truth, if everyone agrees there's no longer truth, yeah, then everyone's a cynic. And if everyone's a cynic, then everyone's a conformist rather than a nonconformist. Because no matter what you hear, even if you hear some important truth, you're going to say, well, that's not, you know, that, yeah, whatever. You know, because if you don't believe in truth, then all that's really left is power and symbols and so on. So it's not just that search for truth, that work to try to get truth right and to express it correctly. It's also the underlying idea that there is something called truth. And in that way, Tony was actually quite, well, he was quite conservative, but I think he was conservative in a way which is actually liberating. I think when you toss out truth, you're really tossing out your chance for freedom as well.
The Bush years, I think, were a watershed in not only the problem, but our recognizing it. The fact that, you know, in this country of hundreds and hundreds of free newspapers and news media that loves its First Amendment, that not one asterisked the selection of President Bush. I mean, it could have been done. They did it with Roger Maris in the Home Run Derby. You know, one out of 1,000 newspapers might have decided to asterisk it. But then the Iraq War, the fact that not one newspaper anybody can name, speaking as elders, as people with memory, people with judgment, people with some independence, not one opposed the war in Iraq, I think was the warning of everything you're speaking about. And it is in some fashion new. I mean, there was much more battling over Franklin Roosevelt or, even almost anything than there was in those recent years. Would you speak about Tony's love of trains? You've mentioned it, but it seems to me a kind of kernel of what he believed about social democracy. And it's also, I must say, an opening where people could say, you know, he was just nostalgic for dear old Europe and the Bahnhof and the wonderful trains anywhere. It seems to me he made a pretty interesting case, though. The train stations, though some of them get knocked down like Penn Station in New York, train stations are forever contemporary. They're modern in a way that airports are not. That there is that common space where people meet and exchange and classes meet in this created common territory. He also said something I had never noticed or known before, that Margaret Thatcher made it a point in her public career never to be seen on a train.
It's hard to separate Tony's biography from his ideas. And one of the things that I was trying to do in thinking the 20th century was to make those connections, because I thought his life was of sufficient interest and his mind was of such sufficient interest that we should try to understand how mind and life go together, which isn't the same thing as saying, you know, there's this experience, it just creates this idea. It's a very complicated process, and the messiness of it and the ways that other people were involved, I think, is one of the reasons why, or at least I hope is one of the reasons why the book is interesting. That said, you know, it's clear that Tony grew up in a way which is quite similar to the way you described you grew up, that is, with the possibility of social advancement there, right? I mean, Tony's dad was an odd jobs man. His mother was a hairdresser. They were, you know, the polite way of putting it would be lower middle class. You know, you could also say working class. But Tony had a good public education, got into Cambridge on a scholarship, and without that, he couldn't have become the person that he was. He understood that possibility of social advancement is having something to do with public goods like trains, that government makes it possible for you to do the things you need to do in life, that somehow fades into the background. And that's part of the story of the welfare state in general, that the stuff that people in America obsess about, like how do I get to work, right? I mean, commuting is one of the great causes of unhappiness in this country. And that's not just an assertion of mine. You know, there's a whole field of sociologists called happiness studies. And one of their big findings is the longer your commute is, the less happy you are, which isn't surprising, right? But it's something which is right down the middle of American life. So what the welfare state does is it allows certain things to fall into the background. You don't worry about retiring as everybody in this country does, because you're going to have a pension. You don't worry about your kid getting sick because you know that there's going to be free or more or less free health care. Those things then fall away from your mind. You don't have to worry about them, and you can concentrate on the other things. So, you know, in Tony's teenage life, the trains and the buses are there getting him where he needs to go, and that means he has a life, right? He has time to read books. He can visit the pretty girls he wants to visit because the services are there. They're in the background, right? They don't have to be the central part of the story because they're there. And what happens with Tony when he's older is he realizes that those things didn't have to be there. They might not have been there. And if they hadn't been there, things would have been much worse than they were. I wouldn't have become the person that I could become. But about trains in particular, something I would point to. Tony was a loner. I mean, as a kid and as a grown-up, he was a loner. But he was a loner who understood that we have to have collectivities if only to become the proper sort of individuals, right? Like we can't become individuals all by ourselves. We can't be responsible. We can't be interesting. We can't be any other sort of individuals without some kind of collectivity. I think the train, just to make a different point than the one you've already made, the train is that when you're on a train, you can be all alone. I mean, you can be reading your book. You don't have to be paying attention to everyone else, but you are with other people. And the only thing you have in common with those other people is that you're going to the same place. You're going in the same direction. But the process of being in the train is one of looking around and noticing difference, right? So you can be alone together. Mm-hmm. Which is different from, on the one hand, you know, the American practice of being alone, right? Commuting in your car by yourself, staying up late playing a video game. You're alone. It's also different than the kind of radical socialist or communist dream of being together, right? We're all part of the same working class, and we're going to get rid of all those other people who aren't part of that working class, right? It's somewhere in the middle. It's alone together, together alone, alone together, together alone. And that trains give us that. And in some sense, I think that's what modern society has to be like. The alone is kind of a nightmare. And the together is a kind of a nightmare. It's the alone together, you know, which is tenable and which we can make if we want to make it.
In the American public conversation of the last 10 years or so, I mean, you saw Tony Judt on Charlie Rose and you could choose to read him in the New York Review of Books, but he came to dismiss, should we say, mainstream media as a propagandistic place and stupid by and large, unchecked. Tom Friedman, David Brooks et al., he held in minimum regard. What did he think had happened, and who did he think had bought them?
You know, that's a question I can only answer very, very partially. It's easier for me to describe what Tony thought was wrong than how it got to be that way. What Tony thought was wrong were fundamentally two things, that there is a disconnect between expertise and exposure. In other words, the people who are talking about things are not necessarily the people who know about things, right? Because, you know, America arguably has the biggest intellectual class now of any country in the history of the world. But the people who know about things are not generally the people you hear talking about things. You hear the same people talking about things that they don't particularly know anything about. That was one side of Tony's critique. And that would be the David Brooks side. The Tom Friedman part of his critique was that it's all become so personal. So, you know, he makes fun of Tom Friedman for always referring to his sources. And so he makes of Tom Friedman an example of how knowledge is not really knowledge. Knowledge is only a sort of access. It's acquaintance. I know such and such a person, therefore I'm in a position to write an article in the New York Times. On the one hand, there's no connection between exposure and expertise. On the other hand, there's this confusion of knowing people and knowing things. And so between that, you can read the New York Times week after week, he would have said, and not really learn anything. But it's not that he rejected the media. I mean, he thought that the media were what we have, and he wrote in the New York Times himself, and he wrote in other media outlets himself. And I think he would have said that insofar as you have ideas, you have no choice but to fight to get your say in these outlets, even though the currents are clearly flowing against you.
Tony Jett referred to the 90s and the first decade of this century, whatever we call it, as the last decades, and he wasn't terribly hopeful about the crop of our politicians who might lead us again. I mean, he was a boomer himself, but he referred to the Tony Blairs, the Bill Clintons as politicians light. He saw neither conviction nor authority in the politicians of today. We know his warning about consumption and selfishness and materialism and isolation, but what was his hope? He did say, don't just sit there reading these books, act, get together, make a move on the intuition of catastrophe. But what did he mean? What should we do, Tim Snyder?
Well, I think one of the most appealing things about Tony was that he historicized himself. He didn't think that his generation was right. You know, very often people of my generation have the problem with the baby boomers, that the baby boomers always think they're right. I mean, even as their own opinions change radically, you know, they always think that they're right, that theirs was a chosen generation, which does seem a little troubling to the rest of us, given the sort of the general mess they've made of things. So one of the things that I liked about Tony so much was that he parted company with his own generation. He parted company with some of its obsessions, and therefore he's a little bit less defensive, I think. Well, what I mean is the dialectic of illusion and disillusion, the idea that you're a great revolutionary generation, and then you learn that you know, the revolution was a mistake, and then you put on a tie and you argue that you either keep the ideology, you know, but you just reverse it. You say, okay, well, I used to believe in Maoism, but now I really believe in capitalism, you know, or I used to believe in communist liberation, now I believe in the liberation carried out by the U.S. Army, whatever, Paul Wolfowitz. You know, you either that, or you just kind of give up and you be like, you know, like Clinton, and you just become a compromiser on everything. I mean, those would be the sort of two baby boomer habits, I think, that, you know, one would identify that, but you continue to think along the way that, like, whatever it is you're doing, you must be right because you're the one who's doing it. Whereas Tony realized that he had taken some wrong turns and that one had to revise one's views. And so you can look at his relations with other people of his generation, often of a similar background, in these terms, that he, you know, in criticizing the Iraq War, which was the great war of many former leftists of his generation, right? It was the great war of many people who in 68 had been ideologically on the left, and by, you know, 2003 were ideologically on the right, often holding many of the same views, just, you know, in different...
Christopher Hitchens, say.
Yeah. I mean, Christopher Hitchens is a good example. The whole move from thinking, okay, we can transform the world by way of the working class or the peasants around the world, to the move of saying we can transform, you know, the world by way of essentially the same people, right? Because our army is now a class army. You know, our army is now recruited from the poor and then often the stateless. The working class now wears U.S. Army uniforms, you know, and now has American weapons. But we're going to, you know, it's going to transform Iraq into a democracy. You know, so I'm oversimplifying, but this sort of swing from one thing to the other, I think Tony was exceptional in that he didn't swing along with that. He learned to be critical about all these big stories and about all sources of conviction about where things are necessarily going to lead. You know, because one of his criticisms of the war in Iraq was this idea of predictability, that you could really think that if you invade Iraq, you can then predict that it's going to help Israel, it's going to lead to democracy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. A whole lot of things are going to intervene and make that story much more complicated than it seems. But we're getting away, I think, from the main thing, which I think, you know, Tony thought, and I agree with him, we have to understand about the future. The thing we have to understand about the future is that the state is here, and the state is what we make of it. By the state, I mean the government. That it's here, and it is what we make of it. That is, it's not just the victim of stories. It's not. It isn't going to wither away. You know, Marx said the state is going to wither away, and that's what Romney and the Republicans also say. They say the state is going to wither away, or as Grover Norquist puts it, we should get it so small we can strangle it in the bathtub. The state is this thing which is very awkward for all these clean stories about our destiny. But the state is, in fact, the thing that we have in common. The government is the thing that we have in common. And insofar as we are a community, as far as we are a nation, which is a word I don't have any problem with, then the way that we interact with each other is inevitably going to be through that government. That government is going to be how we decide who gets what, who should get what. And when we give up on the state, when we give up on the government, we are giving up on the nation. We're not just giving up on justice. We're giving up on patriotism. And this is something which I see as a problem on both the left and the right in this country. We've been obsessing about, in this conversation, about what I think of as right-wing anarchism, you know, the idea that the state can't do anything, therefore we should just let it wither away, et cetera, et cetera. That's right-wing anarchism. But then there's also left-wing anarchism, you know, and what the Occupy movement and the Tea Partiers have in common is the anarchism. One is right-wing anarchism, one is left-wing anarchism. And you can find one more sympathetic or one more understandable than the other, but they both have this deep suspicion of the state. You know, the idea that you should get rid of the Federal Reserve is something you can find on both of these. And the thing is, that is just giving way, giving in, surrendering to big, simple, clean ideas. If you just got this baggage out of the way, you know, everything would somehow be good. But the state, the government, it isn't baggage. It's the thing that we have in common. And what it becomes is what we choose to make it. And so we have to be aware that, you know, whether we're on the right or whether we're on the left, we have to be aware of the moments where we're giving in to stories that delude us, stories that make us slumber. And we have to be responsible, active. We have to believe that we ourselves can make a little bit of difference with respect to the state. And the state is the thing that we make a difference to, that you can't escape that. You know, we have a government. The question is, what should that government be doing? And why should the government be doing that? And the thing is, that's not as inspiring as the revolutionary story from the right or the left of let's get rid of this, let's get rid of that. You know, it's not utopian. Things are never going to be perfect. It is what we've got. And taking responsibility for what we've got is as far as I think as Tony's recommendations would take us. Unfortunately for that, for us, that's hard.
Tim Snyder, I'm looking for last words. What were your last words with Tony Judd?
Oh, they were about trains. They were about trains. I mean, when Tony and I were finishing this book, we were thousands of miles apart. I was living in Vienna, and he was in New York. And the conversations were done. They were recorded. They had been edited. And we were getting right down to the end. I was writing the introduction. He was writing the conclusion. So the last long exchange I had with Tony was precisely about trains. My wife and I and our then newborn son had taken a certain train route from Vienna to just beyond Vienna to go on a little weekend vacation. And so he talked about taking that same train. It must have been about 10 years before with his own young son. And so the last thing we really talked about were, aside from the details of editing the book, that was really the last thing we talked about. But the last exchange we had about anything else was precisely about trains. And I think it's no accident that that was a story about community, you know, about families being able to do something together, but also about two families then having something to talk about later on.
Timothy Snyder, thank you so much. And Tony Judd, thank you too. It's been fascinating, and we've just well begun.
Well, thanks for the chance to talk about Tony. It's much appreciated.